After I first read Lecture 233, The Power of the Word, I have been going to a dictionary more often, saying, I wonder if I really understand the meaning of this word. I know how I want what I want it to mean. I know what the session, what the client wants it to mean. But when you use a word, you pick up the energy of what the word actually means. And it's very interesting sometimes to go to a dictionary and find out what the word means to a very large body of people, because they're putting out that energy about that word. And when you try to hold the tail of the tiger there and say, no, it means this, sometimes you can create a distortion. For instance, using the word truth and meaning something else, meaning belief. Well, belief and truth are two different words. So I went to the dictionary about incarnation. When I was 12, or 11 or 12, I was reading Shakespeare, and I read the word rape, and I was precocious to read Shakespeare in the first place, and rape was totally out of my range. So I went to the dictionary, and it said illicit carnal knowledge. And I looked up illicit, carnal, and knowledge, and I still did not figure out what that word meant. I just gave up and went on, figured I'll learn it later. So when I went to the dictionary for incarnation, it said incarnating, and I had that same, great, that's so informative. Incarnating. The second definition, and this is a good dictionary that I've used many times, so I simply respect it. It's obviously not the only dictionary, and there are many, many, many definitions. The second one was the Christian doctrine that Christ became man. It's interesting, because if you, the Christian doctrine, Catholic catechism, that Christ came into flesh, not just anybody, but Christ coming into flesh. I found that interesting. If you throw away the incarnating definition, but the first thing you run against is a religious doctrine. Interesting. The next one was, but it works for what we're teaching here. Divine incarnating into flesh, even though they mean it as Christ. The third one was a bodily manifestation of a supernatural being. I'll buy that too. Okay, because it's easy to call something supernatural just because you do not understand it. The fourth was personifying a quality or ideal. That also fits this lecture and the creation lectures, because the lectures describe when people began being created, that they were created with different aspects of the divine substance. So to some extent, they were created to embody not everything, but one thing brilliantly, beautifully, ideally. Beauty, wisdom, truth, things like that. So that fit. And the last one was time in a bodily form or condition. So I just noticed that as far as this lecture is concerned, all these work. And that's how I'm using the term incarnation. And as you talk about something, you're going around and talking about different aspects. It's like a disco ball. There are a lot of different facets of this. So you can use the same word, but talk about it from a different perspective or a different direction. And that's why I went to find out if there was a conflict between the pathwork use of the word incarnation or incarnatory process and standard English. Didn't bother with task. I just kind of let task go. That's usually not argued about. The second thing that I noticed in this lecture is that the guide declares a different starting point for life. Driving up, I was listening to NPR, and there was a discussion about a man who held it. It was a program about sneezing. And it was a program about a man who sneezed and held it in and developed a hernia and hurt himself. And they were asking the doctors on the radio, is that possible? And the doctor's answer was, I guess so. And this is an example to me of something that happens very, very often in society, among human beings in any culture and situation. And that is that we choose, without realizing it, a starting point. Sneeze, then hernia, equals sneeze caused hernia. because my reaction would have been, sneeze aggravated existing weakness so that you cross the threshold of it being an issue. But in the way they express it, you know, first event, second event, first event causes second event. So in this lecture, the guy is using a different starting point. When I do sessions with people, I call it baselining. You're starting with this argument. I need to back you up. How did you get there? What did you promise? What did you do? Give me some sequence of events, because in the problem, I'm not seeing how we got to the problem. So I'm not understanding the factors involved. In this lecture, what the guide says is that humans consider life to be birth to death, pause, if you believe in reincarnation, birth to death. Guide says that for the incarnatory process, the next life starts at the death of the previous life. So in the incarnatory process, the focus is upon the death from the previous life and what we need to do to get you ready for the birth of the next life. It's really like a 180-degree twist. Okay? The next big thing in the lecture is that the fulfillment of the task is reflected in the manner of death. Okay? So we're going to start from death, and in death, please come in, please come in. Lots of traffic out there. We just needed to go ahead and start. So in the manner of the death, we're going to realize what didn't get finished. What didn't happen? Where did things go wrong? Where were not the misjudgments in terms of human thought forms? Not what did we not plan for, but what fell out from our plan? And what is the best way to go forward based upon what we know as fact? So another way of saying that is, it ain't over till the fat lady sings. Your life's not done until you die. And you do not know that day, and you do not know what's going to happen even in the last hour of your life. So there is no way you can say, I'm done, or I'll never finish. Probable, but you can't go any further than that, saying it doesn't look good. Okay? And in the manner of your death, that's when they've actually got something on paper. And they say, this is what happened. Now. How do we go forwards? So this is the gist of the lecture, the connection between the process of incarnating and the task that you've got, both from the last time, what was left over, what got done, and what's the next task. So if you can see that in that valley between the two lives, that's where the setup is going to be made for the task in the next life.
Quick question, yes. Clarifying. You're saying that the life, a new life begins at this life's death.
No, that's why I have a little gap here. Okay, there is a death and there is a birth.
Right.
Okay? The death begins the incarnatory process,
right.
Not the next life.
Right, okay, got it.
Okay? And then, once you incarnate, the incarnatory process stops.
Right.
It's done. So it's like handing from one to the other.
Like here and there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. And please ask questions, because if I leave something clumsy or ill said, it's not going to help as I go on. So in your human limitations, you've got three things. You've got fragmented consciousness, which means you're not all here. Okay, you come from a place where you're all there, but the whole point of incarnating is to take a part of you and to shine the spotlight on that and do some work on that. Okay, you've got loss of memory because, and I always do this in joke format because it's much faster and easier. What's the point if you've got the manual? What's the point of life and of challenging yourself if you know how it's going to end? It makes no sense at all. The whole point of challenge is to find out if you're going to meet it. If you know exactly what it is, it's also very easy to run around that. Okay? So you've got to have loss of memory. You cannot remember what the setup was or exactly what the point was from the moment of birth. And part of life, according to the Patrick lectures, is regaining your memory. Okay? You can regain it, but it's a slow and difficult process, and it's earned. Third thing is that, and the guide very often says that he can't explain spirit sometimes because words aren't adequate, and you don't have the experience in your current memory anyway. So if he described it, you wouldn't know what he was talking about, and he doesn't have the words in, I keep using English because I'm speaking English, there aren't the words in the language, and the guide spoke English, there aren't words in English to describe that world. It's too complicated. So one of the ways I describe it is we have five dimension, and the guide speaks of different numbers. I find it interesting that there's no specific number. He changes his numbers all the time. 20 to 1, 40 to 1, 14 to 1. He's got more dimensions that he's working in than we are. So as that translation of a situation comes through the portal of language, it must also come into the reality of this planet, different from the reality of other planets, where there may be more or fewer dimensions. One of my favorite tools for teaching spirituality is the essay called Flatland. And I can't remember his first name, but the gentleman's name was Abbott. And he was a mathematician in the 1800s, late 1800s. And he couldn't get his students to get fifth dimension work. So he wrote a little essay like Carol did about Alice in Wonderland. He wrote a little essay called Flatland. And his estate still sells it at cost in bookstores. It costs $1 for this little tiny book. And Flatland is a query, supposition, a metaphor that proposes that there are only two dimensions in Flatland. Okay, so that you're as thin as a piece of paper, you're thinner than a piece of paper because paper has thickness and flat land does not. So you live on a flat line, okay, and you can only see length. That's all you can see is length. So in flat land, if you're looking, if you're on this plane of existence and you're looking at something and it's a circle, it never changes because a circle can rotate as much as it wants and it's still the same width. But heaven help you if you're looking at a line, because it becomes however long it is and then turns into nothing. However long it is and turns into nothing. You can only see from one viewpoint. And in this essay on Flatland, the fellow who is the protagonist in this goes, you know, but there's no word for it, right? But he goes there anyway. And he looks at the land of Flatland, and he sees circles and lines and shapes and says, I got it. I understand why the world seems to get big and small. And some things, I get it. And he comes down, and they lock him up. Okay? Because, number one, he has no vocabulary. And secondly, he saw it, but how does he tell the others? That is, to some degree, what learning and being involved in spirituality is like. You're asking to understand a world that you really can't contain in the way you're used to understanding and learning. So I shorten that to five dimensions versus more, however many more there are. So it's a dilemma in the explanation of this whole process. So another issue that the guide raises on difficulties of explaining this and understanding it is that we have a reliance upon linear. So I wrote a little stock chart here. Okay, that is not how you're going to understand your incarnatory process, and that's not how you're going to understand your life task. It's not linear. Okay, there's no goalpost. There's no moment of victory. It's a process in the deepest sense of that word. So when we try to make it linear, when we try to get a bullet chart for getting through life and a list, we're going to have problems because we're trying to put a multi-dimensioned object onto a simplistic format. And then you've got the dualistic thinking, you know, the magic bullet that we're born with the minute we're here, and that is that if there's a right, there's a wrong, and if there's a good, there's a bad. Now, you can say, I'm not being dualistic, but if you're using words to describe something as a plus, there's an invisible minus associated someplace in the universe. You can't have one without the other. Okay, so dualistic thinking is inherent in everything we do, and it's part of the plan. Okay, so it's not an accident, it's not a problem. It is part of the maze that we're expected to navigate. So this is what the guide lists as human limitations. I have notes for this, because I know people like notes, and I will be happy to email them to everybody. Okay, so that you don't have to take this unless you choose to. They're more extensive than this, because I had to shorten it to fit it on the page. Whoops, don't do that. So, you've got, talk about life task. The guide describes is that an aspect of your being is sent out. Okay? And it is sent out to be purified and transformed. Now, you just can't keep in, I can't keep in spirit with this. I think it's better to be funny about it. You've got a problem, and you send the problem out to be fixed. It's like sending a dry cleaning out, except it's part of you. Okay? And the incarnation is naturally chosen for the task to purify and transform this aspect. Now, 34 is fascinating. I think it's an absolutely fascinating lecture because it talks about all the planning that has to go into this and how complicated it is. And I translate that into my silly human mind in imagining a big corporate board table and a lot of paper cups and coffee and crumbs and napkins and charts and balled up pieces of paper as my team and I try to figure out how to purify this aspect. So to purify it, the first thing I have to do is basically make it bigger. Okay? I mean, it's small because I'm pretty good. I'm up there in heaven and I'm trying to get better, so how bad can I be? So if the smaller this is, the harder it is to address. So the best way to address it is to make it massive. Okay? Not a little speck, not a little freckle on your cheek. No, a wart on the end of your nose to beat all. Okay, something that you simply cannot dodge and is eventually going to have to be dealt with. Well, that's it. That's the task. So the task lies where the personality and the essence are separated, where there is division in your spirit, in your soul. That's the only place you'd bother to do any work. Everything else is fun. Every other part of you that is purified and transformed is dancing. But if you spend your life dancing, what's going to happen to this aspect? So the life is designed to focus, to truncate a lot of options, and focus and bring attention to the place where you are out of joint, is the Shakespearean phrase, where you are not aligned with God, where you are in distortion, where you hold a belief that is contrary to spiritual law, where you will not surrender, where you will not give in. Now, for a moment, keep in mind that you're volunteering to do this. You don't have to do this. It's not a draft. You don't get here because you accidentally walked in the wrong door. Okay? You get here because you put up your hand and said, I want to grow. I want to accelerate. I want to transform. And all these other worlds, and the guide mentions very, very often, there are other worlds and other situations. These don't suit what I need to do. I need to go to that place. And they will sign you up, and they will start the incarnatory process of giving you guides, giving you teachers, giving you options, you know, looking into your Akashic records, looking at who you are as a spirit, where you've come from, and how fast you've come, and how fast can you go, because they don't want to give you a task you can't complete. Who gets served by that except for the arrogant who have to learn you can't do that in a single lifetime? Okay? So there's all kinds of lessons. So the task lies where the personality and the essence are separated, and the task is fulfilled when the inner being permeates the outer personality. Okay, when the two become one. When your personality becomes aligned with your essence, your divine essence, that's when the task is complete. But remember that we're focusing on one aspect, and we've made it your whole life. It's going to happen over and over again. The guide, the personality lectures in the Pathwork talk about how to look at your personality, how to look at your life, how to look at your dilemmas, your problems, your negative. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to find out what the pattern is. What's the main image? Right? Which is what you're studying, idealized image. This is what you're studying this weekend. What is my main image? That all these things are hanging from like a great big giant Christmas tree. Because if you can get a sense of that, if you can get a sense of your life task, you can obviously pay more attention to it. And when you address things, one of the miracles that happens is, anybody wear cheap clothing where you have a little bit of string hanging out from the button and you're foolish enough to pull it and the button pops off on your hand? That's what life can feel like when you've got your finger on the right string. Okay? But if you've got your finger on the wrong string, you can pull and tug and break and tear. It's not going to work that effortlessly. So part of studying spirituality is another request in this lifetime to go faster. I not only want to come here and do this work, I want to go faster. I want to work harder. I want to see more than I would have if I didn't start this work. Okay? Like, I'm so far out of school, I can't even remember the terms. Not extra credit, but you used to be able to take a course in high school that you...
Displacement?
No.
Extracurricular?
You used to be able to, like, pad your resume. See where I come from. I come from the business world. You want to be able to take extra courses, and they say, but you have to have a certain grade point average, and you have to be doing so well in the other classes before we'll let you take on more work. That's what taking on any spiritual task is like. You know, you've really got to be doing fairly well to afford to be able to take more on, because this is going to increase your workload. It has the potential to make a lot of life easier, but for a period of time it's going to increase, it's going to focalize even more. So, task fulfilled when the inner being permeates the outer personality. Now, let me check.
Question?
Yep.
It makes sense to spend like 2 minutes to differentiate, well, to actually define, since you're so fond of definitions, what this outer personality, also maybe known by the ego, what we're talking about here.
I think that...
Well, that's an accepted...
You can only teach so many lectures at once, in theory. So I'm going to let that one go.
Okay.
I think most people understand the difference between the life as we lead it and that sense inside us that there's more. And it is that simple.
I think probably it's because we just studied the three voices in meditation.
Okay.
And in those three voices, there is the divine universal self.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then there's the adult ego self.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of, and of course there's the child consciousness, lower self, but the idea that we talked about was that it is when the divine self, when the adult ego really reflects
right.
the divine self, which is
right, exactly.
parallel to this, so that's why I'm...
Right. So there's one divine source and many manifestations of that, of the task, the issues, the problems, and distortions. But in the divine source, unless you're confused by negative influx, there's only one. There's only one you. Yes?
In this lecture, it says you can do it either two ways. Either
right.
that you fulfilled your task and your essence leaves, or you, or your personality chooses to die.
Right, we're two slides away from that. Basically, we've got to lay groundwork before we go there. Okay, so yes, that's where I'm headed, exactly. So, because we've got one more thing. Yes. So the signal that your task is not fulfilled, the signal that your task is fulfilled is inner peace and harmony. But the signal that your task is not fulfilled, the guide lists as a vague longing, discontent that cannot be placed. You just can't figure out exactly what it is. You can come up with rationalizations, but they don't last. This is where you say, it's this, and then a week later, no, it's this, and now it's this, because you really can't nail it. If you're not looking for life task, and you're just looking for problem, what's the solution to this problem? Anxiety, low or high level, and if it's high level, it can turn into neurosis. What the guide is suggesting is the positive is a. Let me try that sentence in proper grammar. What the guide is suggesting is that neurosis is a positive in the sense that it is an indicator that you're not on the right track. And in a sense, you're going crazy in some mild, medium, or extreme way. Now, it's also possible that that is part of your plan. It's very complicated. This is not linear. But what are the indicators that you're not on your task and that the task is not being fulfilled, which is a process, not a moment in time, is that you've got such a high level of anxiety that it falls over into neurosis. It's you telling you we're not doing what we're supposed to be doing. So now let's go to the two kinds of death. The first, I found it interesting that the guide, number one, declares that the incarnatory process starts with death and then spends the last half of the lecture talking about death. Could be seen as a little depressing. Example number one, there are two major examples. Example number one, and by the way, this is one of those lectures where you parse the sentences about 14 times looking for the punctuation and trying to make sense of what they're saying. Okay? I kind of knew what the guide was saying and I struggled to come up with any kind of coherent sentence to put in the notes. It is a very confusing lecture. And he says, but that one and this one, you go, whoa, 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 and you have to define what that one and this one is as he talks about a third possibility. So if you get lost in the lecture, I have empathy. I'd like to loan you some empathy. It's a very complicated lecture, easy to get lost in. So the inner being, decision to die. So the inner versus the outer. And the inner says, we're done. Okay, let's go. Let's go home. And the outer stubbornly refuses if they're not connected. So the inner is saying, we're done. We're going home. And the outer says, I'm not going anywhere. Blah, blah, blah. This happens when the outer stubbornly refuses the influx of the inner. So the inner is trying to call and reach and tell you what's going on, and your outer personality does not want to hear about it. It grabs on to theories and beliefs that exclude a human being having an inner divine source. So if I believe that it can't happen, I just throw away the voices, I throw away the messages. Okay? When the outer stubbornly refuses guidance. Okay, so this is the story of the guy in the flood on the roof, and the rowboat comes around, and God will save me, and the Coast Guard comes around, God will save me, and he dies, and God says, I sent you the rowboat, I sent you the Coast Guard. What did you not understand? Okay? Guidance, the lectures present that we're not here alone. That's part of the 34, and so it's not as talked about as thoroughly in this. We're not here alone. We have a team. We have a team of very smart people who agreed that this was a great plan and have signed up to go through our entire lives with us. They believe in this thing. Okay? They are more than willing to give us a few hints now and then if we're listening. Yeah, and we use them. They're not going to make it easy. So it depends on how much cognizance you have? What have you earned that you can now hear this voice? Guidance is, again, not linear. You get it if you need it and you've earned it, or you may not get it because you really need to develop faith in your own abilities. It's very individualistic. There's no way to say this is how it's going to happen. But when the outer stubbornly refuses guidance and stubbornly refuses signs, the inner may say, this isn't working. Now, I imagine personalities because I am one, and I can't imagine not having a personality. And I imagine the guide saying what the guide says. This, we didn't think this was a good plan to begin with, and you talked us into it. But now we know it's not a good plan. You're just not up to it. Come on home. We're not going to punish you. We're going to come up with a better plan. Because basically you signed up for too much, and you can't handle it. And so you're in pain, and it's not working. And we'll start over. But come on home. But the outer personality has the ability to stall off that decision, to stall off death. So when the outer follows the path of easy resistance and rationalizes it, and when the outer moves away from fulfilling the life task, not only doesn't fulfill it, moves in another direction. Okay, these are evidence that the inner is saying we're done, and the outer says, no, I'm going to continue. Now, you would think that the inner has authority, but that's where free will comes in. No, the inner does not have the authority to make you do something. It can, however, allow the consequences to unfurl undiminished. Okay, so remember when I talked about the starting points? You signed up for this. You agreed to this. And when you agreed to it, I'm sure you understood the consequences of dodging it. So if you dodge it, the consequences are going to start to unfold. On the inner decision, the inner decision may be made when the new direction is not possible. You're going down the wrong road, and we're going to be unable to change you back to a road that works for you, for this task, for this lifetime. And what's going to happen is you're going to wind up with a non-organic death. That does not mean you die young, but you can. It does not mean you die violently, but you can. It can mean, and the guide says, you can live to a very, very ripe old age. But there's a quality of hanging on and holding on to it instead of allowing age, allowing the body to degrade, allowing the wisdom to work itself out of allowing an organic death. So when the inner decides and the outer doesn't cooperate, you have a non-organic death because the conscious mind is disconnected. And in an organic death, the two become connected. You become at peace with what is going on in your life. Outer being is totally unaware of what's going on, which makes it naturally resistive. And death is experienced as difficult, painful, senseless, and arbitrary. Now, when I give presentations, we don't do process work. So I tend to come up with more examples from my life than I sometimes am comfortable with. And as many of you know, my mother died in October. And when I read the lecture, I was very struck by this because I was told by a psychic at one point that my mother was not going to get it. and was going to have to pass over before she completed her work. And I almost felt relief because that's her choice, not mine. And all I can do is be loving and supportive and do what I can, because that may have been true 2, 3 years ago, 5, 10 years ago, but free will can change things. When my mother died, she had fallen and broken her leg in New York, so I was here, but she was here with me, and I was on duty 24 hours for 3 days, went to the surgery, went to the pin, the replacement. We were looking at 10 weeks of rehab in New York before we could fly her back to California. Everything was going well, all her vitals were great, and she was angry at me that morning, and I had it. I'd been on board for 3 days with very little sleep, and I was tired, and I did not want to be grumpy with my mother. So I sat and read a book. And then at 4 o'clock, something happened. I'm not psychic enough to know. And she was dead at 6 o'clock. And she was not happy about it. I don't mean to laugh, but it's not my plan. It's her plan. And she was not happy about this. And she was protesting until she went into coma. She was protesting, "I don't want to do this. This is not right." She was fighting for life the whole way. That does not mean she didn't grow. It does not mean that she's not a better person than I am, that her task was not massive, and it might be able to be tied up in a few hours of counseling after she passes over death. All I know is that it was a non-organic death. It was not a death that was relaxed into. And I had the privilege to be with two of my aunts who died organically. And it was a completely different process. It was a very loving and gentle and smooth process, which is how the guide describes organic death. So these are all indicators that there's been a split, the split has not healed, the outer is not listening to the inner, and the task isn't being completed. So remember, the title of the lecture is Connection Between the Incarnatory Process and the Life Task. When you die after a life like this, your next task needs to honor. Why didn't this work? How could my mother spend 88 years and not get what she came to get? And that's what they would be looking at.
So would you think a heart attack, for example, to be organic or not?
It depends. It depends, because we'll go into the next one. You can still have a quick death when you're done. It doesn't have to be, you look a certain way. Okay? And that's where, I'm sure you know, when you teach path work, it's very frustrating for people because it's not easy. You just can't tell them how it's going to be and what it's going to look like. And because every individual soul is working for a different reason, on a different task, with different support, you have to look at the truth of that particular circumstance. And also, the inner pulling the plug is not necessarily a negative thing. It's just that didn't work. And you'd have to be that person and in that guidance field to understand why it didn't work. You know, if I pick a task that is on a scale of 1 to 10, a 9.9 in difficulty, and I don't complete it, you think they should pick on me. If I choose a task that's 1.4 on the difficulty scale, and I don't complete it, we may have to rethink a lot of things when we get back, because, honey, you know, it's like you're going to need remedial reading or something. We might send you to another world first, and then we'll bring you back. But this isn't working. We give you the easy stuff, and you can't get through it. Okay, so it's not an indicator of value.
If you complete your life test and you go to the next life, you complete your life test. I mean, you wouldn't know why you're in the life, but when you're up there. What happens if you completed all your life tests that were set out for you?
The presumption is that you wouldn't come back. So when you left, your spirit would not... Why would you be here if this world was not in your highest good?
Well, it says if you're in the lecture, it says if you're in the radius of the, at least in the radius of the path work, that you're at least fulfilling your life task. So even though you might not really know what your life task is, at least you know you're in the right direction.
Right. I'd say that more than using the word fulfilling, fulfilling gives you, that's a process. Are you on the road? Yes. Are you on the right road? Very probably. Okay? But when you use the word fulfilling, it has this overtone of done. You may not get done just because you're... Pardon?
Yeah, but that's what fulfilled is done.
Fulfilled is done. Fulfilling.
We're all fulfilling our life task. I mean, that's the. I see it as a process.
But didn't you say it was your choice to come back?
There is a choice to coming back, but if you want to, what the guide teaches is if you want to accelerate, if you want the fast track, okay, this is it. This is the best place to really learn some lessons.
Like on Earth.
Yes.
Or somewhere.
The guide really says that this is one of the, if not the one of, the best places to work.
Right, so look at it as, if, like, you know, we have already hundreds of lives probably. Sometimes you fulfill your life test and sometimes you don't. But if you do fulfill your life test, then... You get another life.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Let me give you an analogy that I learned when my kids were...
Now
you
get left back. Let
me give you an example.
You're only up to four. You got like about 96 to go.
How do you know?
If you ever played video games, and my kids got me involved just long enough so that I had a taste, what is your reward for going to the next level? The monsters are faster and they have bigger teeth. That is your reward. If you finish a life task, they're going to put more on your plate because you have proven that you are capable at a certain level. Why would you not advance? That doesn't mean you dig more ditches. It just means that the task, which is nonlinear and unique to you, would be scaled up in difficulty factors so that you could complete these lifetimes faster rather than sooner rather than later. And the truth is, we don't know. We have no idea. We really don't know how far along any of us are, because the guide describes in this nonlinear situation that you can have a spirit that is doing a very important task, who has, pardon the joke, but I don't know how else to say it, chopped off both arms and both legs and is living in an iron lung. Because for that particular spirit, that is a task, living day by day with no access to the outside world and no ability to interact as a normal human being. That task is more important than anything anybody else can do or build or say or teach. You cannot compare the two. The other element here is that every person on the planet was given a hall pass. Here you go, you're all signed off. Go down your lesson started in room number 3. Go ye and sin no more. Have a good time. They give you the pass and you come in. Okay? You had to have permission to come here. Think about that.
Think about the fact that every human being on the planet got permission from the spirit world and a particular team. They got their plan signed off. And they're blowing each other up. Or stealing or robbing. Or they're in prison for their life. All these people are divine spirits and they all have a plan. You can't judge what a plan is or how to complete it or what your task might look like from the outside limited culture.
Some life tests are easier than others.
That's true. And you may get an easy one if you've completed a hard one. What I'm saying is, from our perspective as human beings, there's no way to judge what's going on.
And didn't you say earlier, though, that there's some point when you don't have to come back?
I'm sure there is.
Yes.
Notice that I'm here, so how would I know about that level of development?
I know. I've read a few books, and I remember someone saying that he used to channel and couldn't wait until he did die. He died at, like, you know, 85 years old. He was a professor. Anyway. And he had a student, and so he finally died, and then he was able, she kept waiting to hear from him, and finally she was able to channel from him, and he says he's met all kinds of people, and they don't have to go, there's other levels and dimensions that they can go to, and so...
Right. The only experience I have of that is Emmanuel. So I heard Emmanuel say, and I've seen it in writing from his transcriptions of his workshops, that he incarnated once.
Wow.
And when I heard him say that, I'm reading something into this that's like, once, and I'm done. You know, so I have a lot of empathy for you people because that's really, really hard, and I want to help you, but I only came here once. And maybe only to experience so that he knew what he was talking about. And the guide never incarnated. Okay, so there are spirits that don't need this. But you don't come here to show off. You don't get to come in here and show us how stupid we are because it's not easy for us and it's easy for you. So even when you come in as a very enlightened and wonderful and intelligent and wise person, you're working on something.
You're saying that the guide says he never incarnated?
Emmanuel says the guide never incarnated.
Oh, okay. Because in the cosmology thing, I just happen to remember this. The guide, because I checked on the word, the guide happens to use the word excarnate. He talks about, and now he may not be referring to himself, but he talks about excarnate spirits, which I said, what kind of word is that? It should be discarnate, which is my opinion, you know. And so I thought he was sort of implying that he might have...
I say it with a smile, but that's what Emmanuel said. And he said the guide never incarnated, and that he had once. So that's the variety. That's all the variety I have firsthand information of. With that particular.
But when you mean didn't incarnate, you mean just in
this world.
This world.
This world. Right. So heaven only knows. Pardon the pun. Where he incarnated and how he learned what he needed to learn. But we're talking about here, and we're asking, well, what was the guide like when he was alive? Well, never made it to this plane. Either went past it, didn't have to come here. Don't know the details.
As far as life tasks, do you mean life task or life... tasks.
Depends on the person. But there's usually a central point. In the work that you've done, and I don't know you at all, but
in the work that I've done with people and the work that I've done with myself, it is my experience that there's we're like walking around a certain point that we're that all our problems have seem to relate around a certain core thing. That's why the teachings on the idealized self-image and the main image are so powerful. You get that one, and it's like if you address the spine of the Christmas tree that everything else is hanging off of, it's a lot, you know, once you really change the distortion in that, then it's easier to change the externals in your life. It's easier to change, you can't change what you've done, but you can change what you're going to do. And you have a much better sense of direction, much better sense of the inner you, of your own personal soul integrity. It changes everything once you find out what you're here for, even if you're never able to express it in 25 words or less.